Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station. Hello, and welcome to Dig This, Trump Watch, with host Professor Parker Pollack. Hello, Professor Pollack.
Hi, Pamela.
Trump Watch airs the first Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. I am Pamela Spoto, and Craig Boyer will join our discussion.
Hello there.
Hello. And Shane Houchins is our engineer. There are so many things to talk about, Professor Pollack, concerning this administration, and we have a list of items that we may cover today as time allows, and I think I will just read them, point them out to our audience. So the first one that you may be talking about is the emerging health plan, or President Trump's economic IQ, or Trump's obsession with anything dealing with Russia, concerns about Trump's mental health, and of course, we will continue the search for the great era that Trump refers to in Make America Great Again. So, Professor Pollack, where would you like to begin today?
Well, as you mentioned, Pamela, the sky's the limit, really, in things we could talk about. That list you read through is pretty all-inclusive for today. At the end, if we have time, we could consider some things. I just thought of it as you were reading that list of substantial events that have occurred in June's past.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so if we have time, we could take a look at that. From our last show, show number 5, there are a couple of things that were hanging on. I've got a comment from one of the people that I work out with at the gym. He wondered about the sequence of events after the French got beat in Vietnam in 1954.
Oh.
Then how did we get involved in the situation there, and what was our thinking and all of that? Not to drag it out with too much detail, but yes, the French did get beat in May 1954. 13,000 of their troops had to be shipped home. At any rate, at that point, the settlement that the French and the Vietnamese worked out was a 2-year waiting period where Vietnamese from the northern part of the demilitarized zone, they could go south. Ones from the southern part of the demilitarized zone, they could go north. There were not two countries. It was still just one country called Vietnam. And so in that 2-year period, in fact, the United States helped transport people who wanted to go from the south to the north or north to the south. The U.S. Navy was involved in that. And a former colleague of the Pam and I worked with for years was involved in that when he was in the Navy. At any rate, so you have that 2-year period. At the end of that 2-year period, so July of 1956, there's supposed to be an election held, and the Vietnamese people are supposed to pick a leader in some sort of a representative government. The United States at that point wasn't going to allow that. We were going to create a country called South Vietnam, and we had, or President Eisenhower, had the Dulles brothers in charge of that effort. One was the head of the CIA, and the other one was the Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, I think.
Yeah, right. So the Dulles brothers had set about to make sure that the election didn't happen and that we found a fellow who was hanging out with, you might say, with Cardinal Spellman at Mary Knoll Seminary. He had been discovered, no, Diem, Diem was his name. He had been discovered by Senator John Kennedy and thought to be a good non-communist alternative. And so he was flown to Saigon, put in the palace, Bao Dai, the emperor, agreed to take off and go away. And so we have our puppet there. And between the 1956 and 1963, you got that, 7-year period where Diem was our guy. We paid his army, we paid his staff. The Michigan State University sent their political science people over there. They wrote him a constitution. I mean, it was just a very elaborate scheme. Trained the palace guard, and the army was told that if you don't protect Diem, we won't pay you anymore. The United States will not pay you anymore if you don't protect Diem. So that was the setup. In 1963, then President Kennedy had it up to here. I'm pointing at my neck now. Had it up to here with the way in which the South Vietnamese military was treating Diem, and Diem's reactions to all of that were pretty outrageous, as he took it out on the Buddhists, on the monks. And you might remember, some people may remember in the audience, pictures that, well, you're sitting there having spaghetti and tossed salad here in Reading. You watch on the TV, a monk comes out and sits down in the middle of the street. Another younger monk comes and pours gasoline all over him, and then he lights a match and self-immolation. Well, it didn't take long before Senator Kennedy tired of that and okayed the army, South Vietnamese army, to go ahead and assassinate Diem. So in October, toward the end of October, they went ahead and got rid of him, and one of his relatives as well. Anyway, so the change in government then led to a military government, and that's the way it existed for, well, for a number of years. But if you remember late October 1963, when Kennedy okayed the assassination of Diem, a month later, President Kennedy himself was assassinated. So, odd sequence of events there. I've never known anyone to draw a connection, but, well, you know, anyway. So, go ahead.
Professor Pollack, was that well known at the time that the U.S. or Kennedy okayed the assassination?
I don't think so. Robert Scheer has done most of the, you know, foot on the ground research on this, and he doesn't come up in the book that he wrote that I read. He doesn't come up with any evidence of that that the public knew. No. If you go back to, if you go back to our invasion of Iraq in 03,
right,
just before that invasion, in January of 03, the invasion was in March, the Christian Science Monitor, January 22nd, I want to say, of 03, anyway, somewhere right in there, front page, they showed pictures of every leader in the country that we got rid of because we were about to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And so as a courtesy for the education of us all, the Christian Science Monitor put up those pictures. And so for some people, it may have been the first time that they realized Diem was our guy and that Kennedy approved getting rid of him. So, yeah.
Do you think now, just because this is so overwhelmingly, I don't know what to call it, terrible, that most people in the United States realize, because they have been so upset with the alleged Putin situation, you know, with elections and so forth, but the role of the U.S. around the world for decades upon decades upon decades about overthrowing leaders, assassinating leaders, overthrowing sovereign elected leaders around the world. Do you think the American public was really aware that we were involved to such an extent? Were the Dulles brothers? I mean, they just had it. What they had this drive just to for hegemony, I guess, that or anything anti-communist.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Anything anti-communist.
Yeah. I was wondering how many people it showed that we'd done this to on the Christian Science Monitor. Do you remember approximately how many it was?
Gee, I don't, Craig. Oh, no. I wouldn't.
A dozen,
I don't.
Would you say?
Oh, no. The number of people we actually deposed?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they showed 16.
16, thank Except, you.
Well, that's only from 1954, 53, 54.
Till
up to Saddam Hussein, 03.
Okay.
Yeah, so Saddam would have been 17. Yeah.
Okay.
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi would be 18, wouldn't it?
But he's this side of 03, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But Saddam Hussein and then Muammar Gaddafi was later.
After Saddam.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, right.
So approximately 18.
Yeah,
Noah.
So the list is growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's only since 1954.
Right. And right. We'll come back to that.
Okay. When, yeah. Okay.
But no, I don't. I'm not sure that people are aware of what kind of a role we play in the world. About 25 years ago, the United States, the Pentagon, the politicians, so forth, they got together and they split the world up into six regions. One of the regions is North America. One of the regions is South America. One of the regions is called Pacific. Now that, we all know what North America is, Mexico North, and South America is Central America South. So those are two regions that we have split up, and we have a commander in charge of each one of those regions. The third region is the Pacific region, and it includes China, India, and Australia. And we have, and that's housed in, the central command there for that one is housed in Hawaii. So China, India, and Australia are in the Pacific region. The other two involve Europe, as you might imagine. The northern part of Europe, well, it would be Europe, the Balkans, West Asia, the Middle East. Let me see if I've got that. Let me go back. The major European area, area number four, includes Northern Europe and Russia. And the sixth area that we've carved the world up into is called the Central Region, and it's the Balkans, West Asia, and the Middle East. So we have the world split up into these six command areas, we call them, Central, and I left off Africa, it was actually number six, and all that whole continent of Africa is a command area. So the Central area, which is Europe, Africa, which is Africa, the European area, which is Northern Europe, Pacific, which is China, India, and Australia, and North and South America. So we have the world chopped up into six regions, and each region has a command center.
When you say we, do you mean primarily the U.S.?
Only the U.S.
Only the U.S. So approximately 25 years ago, U.S. top whoever decided they were going to break up the world in these six sections or six areas.
It happened slowly. They all didn't get developed at the same time. As things erupted, then somebody would be put in charge of everything we're doing in the European area and Russia. And so some guy would be in charge of that area.
Is it safe to say that we are an imperial power?
Yeah, I think sure. That's safe. The problem, it used to be years ago when McKinley had a talk with God and decided to invade Cuba and take the Philippines. And the conversation, I guess, he didn't really say the specifics of it, but it led him to the conclusion that he should do that. You know, the white man's burden and all that. So at any rate, when that whole thing started, the word imperialism used to mean reach out, grab up a chunk of the world physically, geographically, gobble it up, gather up its natural resources, whether it's oil or minerals or coffee
or bananas,
sure, whatever. And today, though, I think it means, as you probably imply, it means control. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to take possession, but we have ended up with these six command areas, so we govern the world from our point of view. And we have troops in at least 108 different countries, which indicates that each one of the six zones, we have staffed at least 150,000 troops involved. I mean, we're still looking at 35,000 in Germany. We're looking at 30-some thousand in South Korea. You know, the list goes on.
And that was another, not that I want to go there right now, but that was another reason for that I read something very recently about southern Syria and the U.S. the U.S. really directly confronting Assad in certain ways right now. I mean, we're shooting down a government aircraft and so forth. But this reporter was saying that the U.S. would like to establish a permanent military base in Syria. And this just goes along with the 100 and some that we already have around the world. And then we wonder, I wonder why people do what they do in response to the U.S.
There was a fellow named Correa who was the president of Ecuador, and President Bush, number two, and his administration were making inroads to see if President Correa from Ecuador would let them put a military base there. And he said, his reply was, sure, but I need one in Miami. And they wouldn't let him do that, so the deal fell through.
And I think it's important for our audience to know, too, that, I mean, we do, I thought it was quite a bit higher than 100 military bases, but whatever, let's say over 100 military bases around the world. But I think the next country has 11.
We are so far.
We have 700, over 700, definitely. I've read that many times now.
That just a tremendous number of military.
I think the way I ran into the phrase was bases, not just places where we have people stationed. Craig, you've got a figure there that's probably more realistic if you want to look at where we have people stationed. Rather than an air base or only. But you take a look at southern Turkey, we've got an air base there, Incirlik, a huge operation. And we pay rent. Lots of money goes into the rental of the land that we use for the bases. So.
Well, at some point, maybe today, in today's show, we can talk about all that money that goes into military bases, weaponry, and so forth, versus what we're lacking here in the United States for our own infrastructure and education.
So and health care.
Mm-hmm. And health care, of course. So
yeah.
Proceed, well, yeah, Professor
okay.
Park.
So we get back to what happened then with Vietnam after Diem was assassinated by his army and hauled off. We then went through a period from 1963 into 1973 where we had a series of leaders who were military. And so it was really a political-military combination that ran that country until 1973 when Nixon and Kissinger helped engineer a deal in Paris so that the Vietnamese were satisfied that we really were going to leave. And it wasn't just going to be a holding operation. So it, in that 10-year period after the assassination of Kennedy and Diem is kind of a, it's very controversial a period, especially when you get to 1964. Kennedy was assassinated in November of 63. Lyndon Johnson took over. We had an election coming up in November of 64. Lyndon Johnson said that he was not going to send American boys to Asia to do something that Asian boys should do. Don't worry, we won't have any escalation in Vietnam. And he didn't do anything overt until after he got elected on his own. He didn't want to just be the lame duck president covering for Kennedy. So, however, in August of 64, I mean, he's looking at the election coming up in November, but son of a gun, in August, there's this incident in the Gulf of Tonkin off the, well, part of the South China Sea, where some ships, for us, it's the Matic and the Turner Joy, a couple of destroyer escorts, they're running what we called O-Plan 34A raids up the coast from South Vietnam to North Vietnam, and son of a gun, one of them gets shot at, and one of them gets hit. There's some discussion about whether they both actually got hit, but President Johnson, I have him on tape saying that he knew that we were doing those raids, and he likened it to getting too fresh with your girlfriend, you get slapped. That's, President Johnson had this way of coloring certain sorts of issues, but yeah. Oh, and so at any rate, yeah, you have that incident, which he went to Congress then, and he said the raids were unprovoked. He said it twice, that we didn't provoke them to do this. And he knew full well about O-Plan 34A. So at any rate, that was one of the lies that got us involved then in the escalation. As soon as he got elected in November, by the spring of 65, here we go. We're off and running with Operation Thunder, which Rolling Thunder, which he had in a pamphlet somewhere in his desk. And so then starts the escalation. And he admits to one of his advisors by 1968 in March when he announced to the American people, I'm quitting. I'm not going to run for re-election, blah, blah, blah. If I'm elected, I won't serve, and so forth. And so Hubert Humphrey then tried to get elected and couldn't, and Richard Nixon was elected and finally ended the war in 73. But there was a place in there where Lyndon Johnson actually was telling one of his associates, this is the heck of a, he didn't say this, but this way, he said, this is the heck of a situation. We can't win and we can't leave. That's running through the President of the United States, his head.
Knee deep in the big muddy and the big fool said to push on.
Push, yeah, yeah. Well, anyway.
It is so fascinating and once again, so tragic. And I was never quite clear on the Gulf of Tonkin, but I'd heard that it was a false flag, but I wasn't quite sure, you know, what was going on. So President Johnson was saying that it was an unprovoked attack on these raids. But previous to that, he'd been joking about about a girlfriend getting slapped?
Well, when it happened that the Maddox and the Turner Joy were fired on and one of them got hit, he was told about that, and he said, oh, it looks like when you're at the movie and you get fresh with your girlfriend, you get slapped, and we just got slapped.
Right,
because
right.
Because he knew that the raids were provoked.
Right,
because
right.
We were running up and down the coast, so yeah.
So once again, just another false reason or a reason based on, a war based on lies or escalation based on lies, and then it's just atrocious.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, at some point, we might be able to go back when we get a chance to look at the period when we were great and trace. It wasn't just Lyndon Johnson. We don't have time now. We could go back to 1844 and start with Polk someday if we get a chance. So at any rate, yeah.
Well, we could have a marathon, Trump Watch marathon, and we could go back. Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay.
Okay, yeah. Sometime we'll do that.
The other thing that was left hanging from our last show, well, we talked about Secretary of State Tillerson and his relationship with Putin, which is very close. They respect one another. We mentioned Tillerson actually was given the Order of Friendship Award in 2013 by Putin. That's really not a small deal when the Russian president issues that award. So at any rate, we talked a bit about that, and then talked some about Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, and his... he has, I'm not sure we got a chance to look at that, but he has this terrible attitude toward Iran. There's something about Iran, the near as I can figure, General Mattis is a career military fellow. He was around, I think it started in 1979 when the people in Tehran, after they our puppet there, the Pahlavi family, the Shah, when he was kicked out in the fall of 78. Yeah, I guess 78. Within a year, then the people who ousted our puppet there, which we supplied him with millions of dollars, and he did everything we asked, they went ahead and took hostages because they were afraid of what we were going to do to them for kicking out our puppet. So the hostages were taken. And at that point, I'm wondering what Mattis's, Secretary of Defense Mattis, what his thinking was. There were students here at that time in Reading at the community college, Shasta College. I had three of them in my class. They said that not to mistake us for Arabs. We're not Arabs. We're Persians. And I didn't have any background in that area. Had no idea why the distinction was so important. But they were livid that they were not Arabs. They were Persians. And since then, you know, there's been, well, if you went back 1,000 years before Jesus Christ, you've got the Persians in that area, mm-hmm. where today Iran is, which is about three or four times bigger than Iraq. So the Persians have been there, I'm going to say forever, but that's probably not true. At any rate, 1,000 years before Christ, so we're looking at 3,000 years. And I'm not sure that Secretary of Defense Mattis has that understanding that what happened there for these students at our school, when they told me what we did to their democratically elected president, Mossadegh, in 1953, we had Kermit Roosevelt and Norm Schwarzkopf, not the one we're all famous, well, no, his, I think it's his uncle or his father, but two guys from the United States went there, stirred up the trouble, and got Mossadegh overthrown, tossed him out of office, and put the Shah back in. That's 1953. And so I'm sure that Secretary of Defense Mattis, he must know that. He must know that these students, they harbored some hostility towards us and toward me. Here I am working at the local community college, and I'm taking the heat for something, you know, I was, what, 13 years old. No, so we have a background that I'm not sure that Secretary Mattis is familiar with because of his overt dislike, I don't know, there's a stronger words than that, for Iran, for Iranians. It may have been what happened at Lebanon with some, he's a Marine, and the Marines had to give up some of their members there, the attack in Lebanon. So it may be these things coupled together, but how any of us can have a nasty attitude toward Iran is just beyond me after what we've done to them over the years, forced them to take the Shah, and then overthrew their democratically elected government. And so here today, very interesting country. If you get a chance, go ahead and read anything on the culture of Iran today, and you'll find a highly educated people, very upset with the religious dictators that they have. There's a chunk of Iran that is really progressive, that they've had it with religion, with the way religion is dominating their culture. And this is a holdover from their Persian background, I'm sure, because many of these folks still speak Persian. They don't do, and they may be Astro, No, Zoroastrian was the major religion. Their religious leader, oddly enough, was a fellow named Mazda, spelled just like the car from Japan. So at any rate, I'm not sure. I hope that Secretary of Defense Mathis picks up some background about Iran, because what happened right after he got nominated to be the Secretary of Defense, this is a few days before President Trump actually gets inaugurated, but like 5 days before, a Senate subcommittee meets, they interview Mathis, and they recommend him to the full Senate to be the Secretary of Defense. This is before Trump is a president, formally. And so here we go. Friday, January 20th, President Trump is inaugurated. Within hours, the full Senate meets and approves James Mathis to be Secretary of Defense. 2 days later, he sends a letter to President Trump saying, let's do the raid in Yemen. Now, he must have had a running start at this. Otherwise, he picked up information in 2 days, and maybe he's a quick learner. But he went ahead, and his first shot out of the box ends up being what I think he must admit by now, a failure.
They won't admit that that's a failure, though. And is it part of that because of the relationship with Saudi Arabia being such a strong ally? And it doesn't matter that all, I mean, I guess the worst cholera outbreak is happening right now in Yemen because of all the bombing by Saudi Arabia, and that we've supported that. And then when the U.S., as you were saying, is this Mad Dog? Is he the one that's referred to as
Mad Dog Mattis?
And oh my goodness! And children were killed. I mean, it's really an amazing situation. And you know, Parker, I don't quite understand. Maybe it's a lack of knowledge of history. You know, for most people, but I would think that people in the administration that are going to be working these jobs that are going to make decisions around the world, as you say, would have some sense of history, would understand. But we don't seem to learn, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And we have about 4 or 5 minutes before we're going to take a break.
Okay.
And so whatever you would like to say before we take the break, it's really fascinating. I really encourage people to, and not read corporate written history, but a true history. I mean, saying a true history is difficult too.
It is.
But
right.
Often history is written by the winners, and that's what we get. You know, we don't except maybe the people's history.
There you go, Howard Zinn. Yeah.
Yes. So I'm
Mathis must have picked up a lot of information recommending the attack to the president 2 days after he becomes officially the secretary. So what happens then is President Trump approves it. It's going to happen the following weekend, 28, 29, Saturday, Sunday, and has to occur at night, in the middle of the night, and no moon, moon-free night, so they can so you can sneak around. At any rate, what happens is that the our troops land 5 miles from this little village. The village houses a chief bad guy that they're going to try and nail him, and a lot of computer stuff that they hope to gather up the computers and haul them off for the intelligence that's probably hidden in the CD, you know, however you hide stuff in a computer. So at any rate, 5 miles away, they land in the middle of the night, but son of a gun, the drones that are sent ahead make so much noise that the people in the village say, uh-oh. And anybody, I guess, in that area who thinks about attacking anyone else, you don't do it on a full moon. And so every time the moon goes dark in a region like that where you're liable to be attacked, I would think everybody's on the alert. It's like in the old days. There's a song in our country called Horse Thief Moon, and that's a full moon. You can go over and steal your neighbor's horses. So at any rate, when there's not a full moon, then you can attack people. So here we have the attack. The drones are whirling about, and it's alerted. The whole thing fails. The intelligence isn't worth a darn, apparently, now we know. And we lose a SEAL, killed, 3 injured, an American girl gets killed.
Yes.
14 civilians and a lot of livestock.
A terrible, terrible situation. And we're going to take a short break now. And I want to remind our listeners that this is KKRN Community Radio in Bella Vista and Round Mountain. And we're going to play a little of Bob Wickline, one of my favorites. So here we go.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see. If ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years. When we will have about 10 billion neighbors on the sphere, will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? Political pollution is so thick and dark and dense. It contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend.
Hello, and we're back. And this is KKRN Bella Vista in Round Mountain, 88.5 on your radio dial. And this is Community Radio. And today we have, if you've just tuning in, is Dig This Trump Watch. And we were just listening to Take Your Head Out of the Sand by Bob Wickline, a wonderful CD. And we've been learning a lot about history today so far, especially in Vietnam and different leaders, and coming back and talking about Yemen, kind of bringing it right back up to now with a kind of a lack of sense of history of other countries of the world. So, Professor Pollack, what would you like to say now?
Well, Pamela, I'd like to get into the health care plan in just a second, but one thing that occurs to me, the way President Trump has treated Secretary of Defense Mattis, is that he's giving, as he did with Secretary of State Tillerson, pretty much free rein. And here you have a situation where in Vietnam, we had a proxy war we were fighting there with the Russians and the Chinese. The Vietnamese were just the pawns in that game. And the same thing can happen to us here in Yemen. That can be a proxy war for Mattis if he wants to go to war with, which Iran is a major supporter of the Yemeni government. And so now we've got another proxy situation, which leads us into those quicksands of stumbling into war unintentionally or intentionally without a very good plan. So at any rate, we'll keep watch on that and see how it goes.
And this is directly related to all of these other items that we have on our list today, especially in terms of the, I would say, millions and millions, trillions of dollars that we're spending in these wars. And I would suggest that that they are more intentional than unintentional, because there's a lot of money to be made on war and with the weapons industry and so forth.
Sure. If you just took a look at we're supposed to have a semi-ban on trade with Iran. One of the major weapons suppliers in the United States is Boeing. And Boeing... Trump has winked at it, but Boeing is making a huge sale of planes to Iran. And so the work goes on. The money will be made. It's as though, well, like with North Korea, as cranky as everybody gets, and yours truly likewise gets cranky with North Korea, they don't exist on their own. They exist because the rest of the world trades with them. Someday we're going to delve into which are the banks that handle their money, where do they get, who is it that buys their drugs and the guns they make, who is it that hires, pays their leader for the slave workers that he sends them. All of that, you know, it'll take some time, but eventually that will come out as well. So, yeah, at this point, if we could move on to the health plan, the Republicans would like to have an alternative to the Affordable Care Act or President Obama's bill, Obamacare. And again, every time I get a chance to say anything about health care, I have to start with this old rule that I've somehow ended up developing for myself. Insurance has no role in health care.
Amen, brother.
It is not. Yeah, it's the principle is absolutely foreign. I have a very good friend worked out at the gym. He's a local local insurance broker. I was talking to him yesterday about this, and he said, "Healthcare in America has so many different pieces to it that it cannot be solved through the insurance industry." And this is a guy who understands insurance. You can't do it this way. But we will proceed. We'll go ahead and head down this road. The Republicans are working on something yesterday, and maybe it'll come out. Maybe it's come out already today. Another plan, but you can be sure when the Congressional Budget Office gets a chance to take a look at it, probably there will be 20-some million people, 14 million the first year, and ultimately 22 million who will be uninsured. The fellow I was talking with yesterday, the insurance broker, he said, "You've got a family with you know, make $25,000 a year, a wife and two kids, and they're going to pay $600 a month for insurance." He said, "Do the math. This doesn't work." And so if you don't sign up, you're going to get penalized. The IRS is going to lay a fine on you for not buying the insurance, and your family's standard of living will be determined by your health care premiums.
And Professor Pollack, as I understand it, that the U.S. is the only country in the industrialized world that has a for-profit healthcare system, mm-hmm. and that is just absurd. Mm-hmm. And also part of this, and I'm sure that you were going to touch on that, but some people are calling this, rather than healthcare, it's a tax break for the rich, because the way mm-hmm. it was set up, this 3.8% that the richest people in the U.S. would be paying to help subsidize health care. I mean, how many billions of dollars does a person need? A 3.8%, and it wasn't even on all income. It was just on a smaller portion of income. Then these people, if they're forced to buy health care and they're making, what did you say, let's say $25,000 a year, they're going to get crappy health coverage for a high price because they're not going to be able to afford a plan that covers the family with two children.
Sure. No, that's right. Many people in the Republican Party, especially the conservative wing, they like to talk about Ayn Rand and the John Birch Society and Atlas Shrugged and Adam Smith and the free market, the blessings of the free market. They're living in a dream world. The way modern economic systems are set up, The free market as an idea is for children to think about selling.
Certainly not for healthcare.
No. It's not a way to do healthcare. We education. We don't do it that way.
Betsy DeVos is working in that direction.
That's right.
Maybe we will soon.
We probably will.
Yeah.
But the free market really isn't free.
No.
In terms of the competition is squashed. Mm-hmm. And so to say that the free market, you know, this is based on the free market, we champion the free market. I mean, the virtue of selfishness, what kind of a way to live is that? To see how selfish I can be, you know, everybody else, well, too bad for you.
Yeah. Well, if you pick up any econ book and look at the micro section, you'll find there a list of eight characteristics that a market has to have to be free. And I would challenge anyone, short of the lemonade stand run by the kids on the corner in your subdivision, short of that, find a free market that has those eight characteristics. Anyway, so.
Yes.
But the healthcare system in America has an interesting background. We start back like 1920 or so. Blue Cross, no, pardon me, yeah, what became Blue Cross started as a hospital insurance program in Dallas, Texas. They were trying to, in those days, hospitals were run largely by religious groups. And so they weren't trying to make any money. It wasn't a for-profit operation. They started out in a way of just compassion, as their religious principles taught them. They went ahead and took care of people. So, but ultimately, Blue Cross and Blue Shield end up having to go turn into for-profit corporations, like other insurance companies, and we lost that the care orientation.
Yeah. And isn't, I mean, the insurance companies, and we can talk about big pharmaceuticals as well, but insurance companies are probably one of the richest corporations that there mm-hmm. are out there. I mean, mm-hmm. they just really make a lot mm-hmm. of money. And that's mm-hmm. why they have someone sitting at a desk that isn't a medical person, try to get a pre-approved something. No, yeah. we're not going to give that to you. Or you have to fight for every little thing while their executives and yeah. boards are making yeah. a tremendous amount of money. That just isn't right.
Well, the ads that I see on TV for car insurance or health insurance or life insurance, whatever it is, it makes the insurance industry seem like that they're terribly compassionate, and maybe some are, but my experience with claims is that the first message I get from the agent is, okay, let's take a look at the policy. In his mind, maybe this isn't covered. That's the impression I get. The compassion can't be there. It has to be serve the stockholders. That's their ethical and legal requirement. If they're going to do something nice for me at the expense of the stockholders, that's illegal. It's unethical. Compassion has no place in that situation.
And so what happens, in my experience, has been we pay more and more for insurance and we get less and less mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for that sure, insurance. Sure. And then yeah. with the desire to cut Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, I mean, it's just outrageous. But so
yeah, well, if you take a look at what the House of Representatives had and then what the Senate came up with, you end up dropping people off the program. Medicaid gets cut, which is the money that comes to the states to take care of senior citizens, disabled people, low-income.
Low-income, yes.
People in nursing homes.
Nursing homes, yeah.
That's
yeah.
unbelievable.
Yeah, so you have some tremendous cuts there. We have a week vacation for the Senate, I guess in the House also. And hopefully they won't all go to Hawaii and lay in the sun. Hopefully they'll go back home and talk to some of, not the people that sent them, not the financing people who sent them to Congress, but talk to regular people.
Some of the voters.
Yeah, maybe some of the people that voted for President Trump. Talk to those folks and get a fix on what are their needs and what happens if some of these features are in the next bill that actually is signed by the president.
In terms of town hall meetings or talking to voters or the community people, I mean, there's been a reluctance for this Congress to do that mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. the voters are really not happy. And so rather than deal with that, well, we're just not going to have a town hall, or we're not mm-hmm. going to take questions, or we're just going to mm-hmm. give a lecture or whatever the case may be. It's not good.
Yeah. The one thing that would probably affect most families, somebody in almost all of our families, at least one member, has a pre-existing condition.
Yes.
And that is going to fall. I would almost bet money that there'll be something in the bill that will make it seem like it's being protected, and there'll be a backdoor way out of it for the insurance company. Because that's the driver of rates. That's the driver of premiums. One of the major drivers of premiums is covering that. And now, if you don't maintain insurance coverage and you walk into, well, my friend, the insurance broker, he says, you know what happens, Parker? I get a phone call from a guy and says, he said this happened last week. He said, I need some dental insurance. I'd like to buy some dental insurance. And so my friend says, okay, fine. Do you have a mouthful of cavities? And he said, yes. Well, how'd you know? He said, well, you wouldn't be calling me for insurance if you didn't have a mouthful of cavities. He said, that's not the way this works. You can't start making $40 a month payments on a $4,000 dental bill. So we sort of have this thing of dropping out of the insurance coverage, and with the Senate, I'm not sure of how Obamacare works with regard to that. If you don't have coverage, and then when something happens, you go try to get coverage. There's a window in which you're supposed to sign up.
Right.
And if you miss it, I think you may get penalized.
Fines, right. I think that that's the case. And I thought that there was also in this future Trump care, if that's what we want to call it, Bill, that they were going to have a category. This doesn't make any sense of high risk, what we're talking about right here, pre-existing conditions, the high risk category. And of course, that's going to be tremendously, mm-hmm. outrageously mm-hmm. expensive mm-hmm. if you happen to be placed in the high risk category, rather than having everybody in the same pot, you know, people putting in their money. It's ludicrous.
There's only... Well, it just keeps leaping back, I guess, probably to all three of us, that given what we've seen in past discussions we've done on this topic, the administrative costs of the insurance companies run around 20% of their revenue. And if you look at Medicare, it's somewhere between 1% and 2%.
Wow.
That just leaps out, doesn't it?
Yes,
I mean,
it does.
If you want to provide coverage for people in your country, simply expand Medicare. Let people buy into it.
Yes.
As a single-payer program, based on their income, sliding scale, whatever.
We'd save so much money and so much heartache.
Yes, exactly. But I'm not sure when we're going to get there.
I know Elizabeth Warren is trying to push in that direction. But I want to remind our listening audience that this is KKRN.org, Community Radio, Round Mountain, Bella Vista. We are volunteer supported. And you're listening to Dig This, Trump Watch with Professor Parker Pollack. I'm Pamela Spoto, and Craig Boyer is in the studio with us.
Well, the other thing that hit me about the Senate bill was that... there's a fellow we were just talking, Craig, about, Dean Heller in Nevada, senator. He's the most vulnerable Republican senator coming up for re-election, and he's one of the most outspoken Republicans critical of what Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, was trying to get people to buy. And somebody in a super PAC, allegedly one of President Trump's super PAC, not Trump himself, but some of his people then have gone to a destructive campaign against the name of Dean Heller.
In fact, I heard that they—I don't know if it's true or not—spent $1 million in negative advertising against Heller.
Yeah. Oh boy, I didn't realize it was that high.
$1 million is what I heard.
Wow. Mitch McConnell had a comment that I've got written here. When he heard about that, he didn't know about that much money, but he said, "Attacking Heller is beyond stupid." I thought that was kind of encouraging.
That's amazing to hear that.
Now that's what he said in public. I don't know how he really.
He's probably in private going attack.
So, one of the things that happened though is that some quotes came out after the Republicans wouldn't let anybody read the bill for until the last minute there. One of the things that I have a quote here from one of the Republican senators, we have to get this passed before people have time to analyze it. Yeah. And another fellow said, more time will not help the public perception of this bill.
It's going to stink a little more.
These people are very honest about this, hoping that they're – now they've gone on vacation. Maybe there's another bill out today – or pardon me, yesterday, since this is Saturday – so maybe a bill was negotiated, came out yesterday. If so, if it's made public, that'll be a week before they reconvene on the 10th, and maybe enough people who voted for President Trump will get a chance to look at it and see that possibly, since he really did well with low-income, undereducated, low-skilled white people, those are the folks who are going to get nailed by what we see so far from the Republicans. And I don't know that there's any way to hide that from these folks if the senators and congressmen and women go back.
Well, they're so good. Congress is so good at scapegoating, though. So, I don't know. And I was sitting here thinking as we talk about this, and I've been thinking about this for quite some time, this is very, very distressing. Mm-hmm, this is very distressing.
Yeah, it's
I can't imagine people not feeling distressed by this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even if you've had a good job and you make, let's say, a moderate retirement, whatever the case may be, this is distressing.
Yeah, right. There was a comment made by Senator Cruz and one other senator who has a name we would know. Can't remember who it was, but the comment was, lack of medical care does not increase the death rate. I was my mouth dropped open. Somebody jumped on that right away. Stephanie Woolhandler, who is a physician, actually she's teacher, a professor of medicine, New York University. She jumped all over that. She has statistics that show that for every 1,000 people without insurance, I think it's, well, there's some number of people that die early because they don't have access to medical care. So, but once you say something that's so outrageous, the more it gets to be denied, the more people hear that someone said that and how silly or how wrong it is, people like me who keep saying it are actually promoting the chances that it will be believed, even though in my saying it, I'm trying to denounce it. And Stephanie Woolhandler, likewise. So
this is so confusing.
Yeah, yeah.
So by just talking about it, so are you saying that listeners or some people only pick and choose certain things that you say, or because? I mean, that they filter out the whole message that's being said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there are parts of it that are alarming, and there are other parts of it that are just humdrum words in the English language.
Uh-huh.
But when you hear this thing that catches your attention, lack of healthcare won't kill you, that's something that will stick. And if it's followed by, unless there's a blah, 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 and a blah, 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 and all the other modifiers to that claim, the claim will be remembered even though the extras after the claim denounce the claim's validity.
Yes.
Yeah. It's frustrating.
Yep. Well, now I'm really distressed, Professor.
You know, the other day when President Trump was trying to get the Republicans to come around, he had them all 100 of them, I guess, or no, pardon me, 50, 52. 52 Republican senators came over to the White House and had hot dogs or something.
And that's not good for their health.
Oh, dear. Well, anyway, there's a quote that he made as the beating began. He said, "This will be great if we get it done. And if we don't get it done, it's just going to be something that we're not going to like. And that's okay. And I understand that very well." There are a lot of different ways to get the message across, but I think that's an indication of how his mind works, which hopefully we'll be able to get to later today or maybe next time. So after the meeting, it didn't work out, and the Senate Republicans postponed the vote. Now they have to go home and see what they're going to see what they're going to
do with her. And I think one of his latest tweets, we only have about 7 minutes left, one of his latest, President Trump's latest tweets had to do with, well, if we can't get it done, we'll just repeal Obamacare and then we'll fix things later.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, wow, oh my goodness. Wow, so there would be nothing.
And there's no way of getting anything
any guaranteed anything later.
That.
Yes, yes.
Almost no chance of it.
Yes.
Well, some of the things in the Republican bill also would put a lifetime cap on the benefits, and a cap within a year. It looks like what may happen if the Republicans actually do come up with something and the president signs it, it'll be an entitlement drop. Fewer people will be entitled for coverage, and that seems to be true no matter what they've come up with so far. And so we're going to end up with people in states with drops in the Medicaid budget, and then states will then have to decide, are we going to take care of the people in our state or not? Apparently the federal government's not going to do it, and so maybe we'll do it. We'll have to start looking at state by state.
Well Professor Pollack, I'm not sure you want to go here, but I know that in California, was it the assembly or the total assembly passed for single payer in California, but it was the head, was it Rendon? I don't know what his name exactly is, vetoed it. He was the, you know, the head of the, but I'd also heard that Governor Brown, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'd heard that he was not in favor of single payer for California too. So how difficult, I mean, not that, and I'm not trying to steer this in a different direction, but I was hoping that maybe some of the more progressive, saner states would be able to have this single payer for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think Governor Brown or Rendon or whatever his name is exactly said, we don't have the money. And it just infuriates me because we have plenty of money for weaponry.
Oh, yeah.
Trillions of dollars for weaponry.
And that's because we have to take care of the world.
By killing them.
So far, yeah. So far, I haven't
imperial
run.
Power.
Maybe there's somebody lurking in the in the wings that's going to run in the next election that will talk about us pulling back out of these six regions we've got the world chopped up into, and start devolving, coming home a little here, coming home there, coming home a little bit there. If we could, out of a $800 billion military budget, and that's not terribly accurate because there's a lot of military spending hidden in a lot of
yes.
other budgets. But
yes.
Well, Pamela, you ran across a figure earlier about college education for almost everyone
yes.
could be paid for.
It was this F-35 Joint Striker Fighter, and it said it was one of the most useless jets that has ever come into being. And so far, they spent $400 billion. But it was unable to fire its own gun, and they don't think they'll be able to do that, which is probably a good thing, until 2019 because of software issues. But it said that if the military tries to, if it's not scrapped, that it will cost $1.45 trillion, which means we could educate everyone in this country in college for free for the next 23 years.
But
we don't lay this out to the public. What we lay out is fear.
Yeah.
And so more surveillance, more weaponry, more wars, and then you might be safe.
And we have a situation where there aren't a lot of, because of our educational program, we don't have a lot of jobs available for people coming out to have the faced with going in the military, going in the Army. And don't get me wrong, I come from a military background. Two of my uncles were pilots in WW2. I lost one of them over some oil fields in Europe. Uncle Jim flew off a carrier in the Pacific. He came back alive. My younger brother Grant's is a combat wounded Marine. So I understand how families deal with this, but it shouldn't be the only alternative for some of our young men and women as they come out of high school. There should be a bunch of stuff that
yes.
that might be one.
Yeah. I'd prefer it wasn't, but, you know, I mean, I do, you know, it's interesting that every spiritual leader that I can think of has said the only path to peace is peace. And we think for some reason that the path to peace is war. Mm-hmm. And we just continue to get mired in that, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. We only have about 3 minutes left, Professor Pollack. This is so exciting, that you've said today to help educate us.
Well, I think next time, if we get a chance, we'll probably start with President Trump's economic IQ, and I know that he went to college, and I'm pretty sure he was a business major at a named school. I think
Wharton,
it was Wharton
School of Business. Wharton. He took classes there at least.
Oh, okay. Maybe graduated, maybe didn't. But
I don't think he graduated from there.
Okay. Well, because his knowledge of the way an economy, you know, as complicated as these things are, economies today, he doesn't. Let me just give you one example. Right now, unemployment, which is a kind of a foggy figure, but the way we do this, the Bureau of Labor Statistics tells us how many people are unemployed. So it's under 4%. Let's use that. And interest rates are starting to raise because the Federal Reserve System is getting nervous about inflation. And so they're starting to let the overnight rate creep up a little bit here and there. And the President of the United States is going to talk about a tax cut. Now, in the middle of an economy that's starting to boil, we're running out of workers, we've got interest rates creeping up because the Federal Reserve System, which is half responsible for the problem, and the Congress and the President are responsible for the other half, starting to creep up. You don't talk about tax cut. That's not it. That is so basic. I could call up some of my students from 50 years ago and say, what do you think? And they would probably, hopefully say, I don't think he got a good grade on that test. So, we could start there next time, though, with that kind of thing. Yeah, it's just silly, really.
Yes, it is. And I think we really should explore this. So is there any last word that you want to say, or is that your last word, that we're going to continue to explore
his
economic IQ?
Including his concept of international trade, which is also, way behind.
Okay. And thank you so much, Professor Pollack. And thank you, Craig. And this is, so our listeners know this for sure, KKRN.org, Community Radio, Round Mountain, Bella Vista, and we are listener supported. And I would like to thank our listening audience, and tune in next Saturday for Pearl on Politics with Professor Pearl. So thank you again, and goodbye.